Welcome to Coffee and Contemplation, a Stranger Things podcast. I'm Robin.
I'm Heidi.
I'm Jenna.
And I'm Steve.
And this is our Stranger Things 4 season wrap-up roundtable discussion with our overall thoughts of the season as a whole, highlights, lingering questions, and a few other fun surprises. So this is a first. Not merging entirely separate conversations, but having a group discussion with all four of us in one room.
Yeah. I'm so excited.
We have a range of perspectives here, varying from appearances on the podcast, you know, for me, who's been here the entire time, Heidi, who's been here most after me, Jenna, who's joined me in season 3, and Steve, who jumped in for season 4.
I'm a dabbler.
So this should be fun. Let's kick things off with what I'm calling a palate cleanser. Favorite characters, seasons, arcs, like basically what drew you to Stranger Things in the first place, and what has kept you coming back, like despite the frustrations that the show has thrown our way and kept you invested enough to, I mean, hop on the mic with me and look at the show critically, because as we know, once you do that, it can often drastically change your relationship to something like this.
So I've been thinking about this question because we talked about that this was going to be one of the things that we were going to talk about. And as for like, who is my all-time favorite character, I like both very confidently say 11, you know, point blank period. But also at the same time, I don't know that I have like an actual favorite character, because one of the things that keeps me coming back to the show is how strong of an ensemble cast it is, mm-hmm. and how like all of the characters, even if I don't necessarily relate to them individually, they're all so interesting. And they all develop in such interesting ways. And the way that they like interact with all the other characters is so strong and so valuable. Even the like really minor characters, even though they're minor characters, they're so complex. So that is definitely my answer for what keeps me coming back. Even when I get frustrated, for example, like I said, I wasn't really down for Eleven's arc this season because I felt like it was clunky in a lot of ways. But despite that, there were so many interesting arcs with all of the other characters, like Hopper's arc and like the kind of like emotional journey that he took. So characterization is huge for me no matter what I'm watching. Mm-hmm. And it's a real strength of Stranger Things. But if, you know, for some reason that I can't really understand why you would do this to me, if you put a gun to my head and said, pick one favorite character, it would be Eleven.
When we first got started in season 1, I think you said how much you like that character, but I was like, I wonder if it's changed. So interesting.
Yeah,
I would agree with you. Actually, over the entire show, I think Eleven is definitely one of my favorite characters, but in the later seasons, I think it's got to be Steve. I didn't really care for Steve. It's so funny, he's a fan favorite now, and I know he's like a group favorite here too, but like I didn't really care for him one way or the other season 1, even though he has a really good arc. I just love him in later seasons so much, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. He is just this, I don't know, he's so fun to watch. I mean, I love Joe Keery too, also a Joe Keery fan now. I guess I would say in like season 1, my favorite character might be Hopper. He's got one of my favorite arcs. I love season 1, as you know, it's my favorite. That's what really drew me into the show. And once you get me caring about characters, mm-hmm. I will keep coming back, even if the show really falls off the rails. I'm going to finish it. You know, I need to know what happens to them. One of my favorite archetypes in a paranormal show is when you have kind of the old jaded person kind of get that spark of wonder again in their life. And that's what happens to him in season 1. And I just love that so much.
That actually, hearing you say that makes me wonder if that's one of the reasons why, like, his characterization in season 3 bugs us so much.
Oh, yeah, so much. Yeah. It's so antithetical to that.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, like, because Hopper is probably my all-through-the-show favorite character. I like who he is and his complicated relationship with just about everybody, and everybody also looks to him in a caretaking way, and I love that character prototype as well, the person who is such a good caretaker but is not the person who you classically would be like, that's him. And I think seeing all of the stuff that we saw out of him in season 1, because I also love crusty characters, and I loved seeing him like wake up on the couch in this fog of a depression and then see later in the show like why he was or was coming from that place. A lot of that felt very real, and as much as I would want to lean into saying Eleven could be one of my favorite characters and is, I do tend to always have, like, even in supernatural stories, the most human characters are usually the ones that are my favorite. And I also love characters that are thrust into circumstances that are so far out of their understanding and control, and then seeing them put to the test. And I think that that's Hopper a lot. I think he constantly is put to the test. And it seems to me like it's constantly a, should I do the right thing here? Or am I going to do what's serving me? And it seems like Hopper really always makes decisions that are taking care of everybody but himself. And I love that.
I thought you said Joyce was your favorite character.
Yeah, I think, but I, if we're going like through the entire show, like, I mean, I think there's a fanboy in me that loves Winona, and also she's hot.
Fair. That's
and so
fair.
Like, she was the emotional core of the show to me, especially in the first season. That's really what drew me in, was her, like, I'm not letting this go. No matter how extreme the situation got, she was always going to believe what was happening because it was her son. We get to see that, I guess, challenged in a way by a character like Hopper, because he wasn't seeing any of this and not experiencing any of it. So I like when we, the dear viewers, are in with Joyce being like, he is out there, we know, and you're getting there, you're just following the bait, you're gonna make a big discovery, Joyce, but then we've got all these other characters that we, the viewers, are knowing, they are just seeing her as possibly being crazy, you know? We just know there's so much more there.
Mm-hmm. I think you make a really great point about Hopper making decisions that are for everybody's highest good, but not necessarily his own. I think he has that in common with Joyce, and maybe that's part of what draws them to each other, especially as the seasons progress. So I hadn't thought of that. That's really good.
That's something that I think is both really valuable throughout their relationship, season three maybe excepting, but like when their relationship is both platonic and romantic, like they make good like foils for each other at the same time, because they're both like, actually the conversation we talked about in chapter 9, the whole, I never should have done that. I never should have reached out to you. And she's like, it was my decision. They're both keeping each other honest about, no, I'm glad you're not falling on your sword all the time, kind of thing.
When we arrive at the end of the finale, I feel like that becomes present again, like in a full circle kind of way, because we get Eleven being like, oh, like, good of you to have had such a good conference, Joyce. And she clearly followed her heart in a way that I also felt like, yeah, it transcended something, because it was more than love and it was more than friendship. And I think that's something that Hopper and Joyce have, and it's just really, it's really special.
Well, and plus their relationship, the romantic side of the relationship, is forged in this paranormal aspect of things, which is always fun and spicy for viewers, you know, when characters go through shared, it doesn't have to be trauma, but something extraordinary, and it just pulls you together. I love that. And I love the way that they are foils for each other in a lot of ways, but also not. It's just very interesting dynamic.
And I always love a romance that's kind of like on the edge, that will they, won't they, like, are they gonna, oh man, I don't know.
A little bit of a slow burn, but still satisfying, because it doesn't last like forever.
They're both parents, and Hopper's parental journey has been so like broad all over this four seasons, because of having lost Sarah, and then everything he's gone through with Elle, and then Joyce having these, you know, just these sets of kids, but how even that's gone through a lot of changes. Yeah. As for me, I mean, I don't think it's any going to be any secret or surprise. You know, I mean, I've talked over the course of the podcast about how Steve is my favorite character for very specific reasons. But something I've been learning about myself in the last few years is how much atmosphere and setting, how important those elements are to me, both as a writer and as a consumer, as a viewer, as a reader. And I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about as much about Stranger Things that I think actually hooked a lot of us without it being like necessarily super obvious is the setting of Hawkins. Hawkins is very much a character. We've all talked about it at various points about how the Hawkins arc is the strongest in season four. And a lot of that is because I think from the jump, the Duffers were very clear about what Hawkins is. And I think for me, that was just as enveloping in season one as the D&D game. I mean, even just the setting of the Wheeler house and Mike's basement and Hawkins' lab. And those are some of the elements that have remained in place even throughout the sections of the show that I like the least. In season three, I talked about how I think it was an episode, Jenna, that you and I did, where we were talking about like when they first start to like do the theorizing in the Wheeler basement, like a lot of the moments where I'm like, this is where it starts to feel like Stranger Things. It happens to be in those settings. Mm-hmm. So that was just something like I was kind of surprised to realize. Like, I think for me, a big part of the show that I keep coming back for is Hawkins itself.
It's a familiar place. And I feel like for anybody who's probably visited a small town too, it feels like a home. You spend time in all these homely places with the characters too. So you do kind of feel drawn in with them, especially in these, you know, intimate settings. But as we've talked about, like, favorite characters and even Hawkins being a character, I think my classification in favorite characters is also kind of a, I don't know that it's a victim of it, but the storytelling happens to fraction groups of people a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like they do it demographically a lot in particular, like yeah. the kids, the teens, the adults. And so I feel like I almost draw a through line of connected dots that are like, okay, my favorite characters are Lucas, Steve, Hopper.
Okay.
And that's where I think I go through thinking of the whole show on the whole. I think those are my three.
I think that's a nice pivot point to get into some season four specifics. So Steve, you weren't here for our 2022 reactions episodes. So I want to start with you.
Okay.
You know, we touched on it briefly during your introduction in our chapter five episode, but let's dig in a little bit more. Now that we've come to the end of the season, how did season four land for you overall? And how does it strike you as installment four of what will be five compared to the three before it?
Sure. I think as I start to dig deeper, and having even recently, as yesterday, watched the finale again, I feel like this season tried to tie all of the seasons together by doing like an Empire Strikes Back move in leaving us where it does at the end. But it also illuminated so much. All of the discovery of everything that was Victor Henry 1, VH1, I feel like that was us kind of coming to terms with the, oh, Darth Vader is Luke's dad moment.
Mm.
Because now all of a sudden so many things made more sense. There's things now that if I go back and watch season one, it makes sense. Or just where VH1 has been in all of this the whole time now, I start to question or wonder. So it makes my rewatching like a whole new re-examination of the show. Even though when I think about seasons on the whole, season one is hands down my favorite. I agree there. I think that's definitely the best amount of exposition to I'm leaning into. I felt satisfied with how it ended too. And I can't say that worked in every season. Something that I started to really think about too is how much D&D has applied to this show on the whole. And sometimes I wonder if the way that this season came together, a popular story in D&D lore or mechanism to use in RPGs, is like the spell convergence or just when planes start to converge. So at what point in time did the Duffer Brothers receive the prompt that was, how do you tell a D&D story, but in the 80s, and use some of the elements of D&D? Because as I took a screenwriting class last year, I start to wonder, like, what prompted this thought? Tell a D&D adventure story, because that's what this whole thing has been.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that, though, because that was something Jenna and I talked about a little bit, I think this season in Chapter 2, but we talked about it a bit in Season 3, about how there was a very different attitude towards D&D in Season 3. Then in Season 4, it came back with such a vengeance. I mean, with the Hellfire Club in particular, it became so much more prevalent, and it felt way more cohesive with Seasons 1 and 2. But at the same time, more critically, we were thinking, does this actually still work? So that's interesting to hear that perspective on it.
Yeah, I think on the whole, season three is probably my weakest. And then applying that D&D formula as well, I feel like each season kind of had that mystery creature where yeah. it was like Demogorgon, Mind Flayer. Season three was kind of void of what could have been something unique or drawing us in on this classic Scooby-Doo adventure season formula of what is the mystery creature? Oh, Lord, it's this. And it was created by Hawkins again. Oh, no. And then now we get to season four where it's so much more than that now. It's where did it come from? Where is this other place? Where was Henry Vecna during all of this time? What is that world? I have so many more questions now, so I'm excited. Like, maybe I was on kind of a roller coaster journey through season four, but I'm very excited about the end.
Heidi and Jenna, rather than retreading the same territory that we covered in those 2022 episodes, I'd like to hear from you guys, what were your biggest surprises of season four coming back to it for the podcast? Of the things that had changed from 2022, what were the things that surprised you the most?
I don't know that I was surprised by any feeling differently on a rewatch. I guess I'll just say, though, my biggest surprise overall of season four, just in general, is the way they ended it with Max. I was really surprised that that's where they would go with that. But I guess I wasn't really surprised that my feelings for a few things changed a little bit. My feelings overall for season four were still mostly the same.
The things that, you know, I didn't like in 2022, I still don't like. The things that I loved in 2022, I still love. I am, I think, probably most surprised by the fact that I'm, like, sitting here and having a great time. I didn't think that I would, like, have fun doing these episodes and, like, kind of doing these, like, critical analysis and close reading. But I have. I have had a lot of fun rewatching it and talking about it with you and speculating about stuff and digging into stuff. And so, it's been a happy surprise.
Yay. I'm very glad to hear that.
I don't know about you, but I would love to do critical analysis on almost anything, though.
That's fair.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
it doesn't even matter.
Yeah. Like, something I've never heard of. Cool. Let's watch it. Let's do analysis.
I mean, in this room, we're all, like, very, like, artistic. Also all very intellectual. So I think it's kind of like a reflex, you know, that when you're watching something, you're going to be paying attention to, like, the themes and, like, how stuff comes together. And
you mostly have to tell your brain to turn off sometimes. Like, stop it. Just enjoy it.
Yeah, just enjoy it.
This is just for fun. It's fine. Yeah.
I was just explaining to some friends that I tend to go to movies alone, actually, because I love going. I love treating myself. It's a little reward for whatever could have been a hard week, maybe, but I just like going and enjoying a movie and falling into all of my own thoughts about it for a little bit before I'm even like, ooh, what did you think? But I feel like when you go in a big group viewing to any movie, everybody naturally starts to dish quickly. Mm-hmm. And I usually need a lot more time to sit with stuff because I generally just tend to like everything I see because I do start to critically ask questions like, why was this story told? Or what about this worked that it even got greenlit to be produced? And then I'm also like, well, hey, I'm proud of you. You did it. You stuck the landing. You made it. You made a thing. And I think that's really exciting.
I think for me, the biggest surprise was how I felt upset at the end of both seasons 3 and 4, but in very different ways. Like, I think for me, realizing how many of the harsh reactions I had to season 4 really came from, in a way, coming into things with unmet expectations. And that kind of brings me back to how I started this season, which is the mixed bagness of it all. I realized I didn't talk much about that through the episodes themselves, but I think a lot of our conversations speak to that. One of the things that Heidi and I just talked about in Chapter 9 was how shocking the ending was in terms of Eddie and Max, and how surprising Eddie's death, how hard it hit, and how much that retroactively affected my entire experience of season 4. I mean, my reaction coming into season 4 was, I feel like it's Stranger Things again. And then at the end, feeling like this is not the show I recognized at all. And I don't feel that way anymore. There are still, like, individual pieces, but collectively, I don't feel that way. And that, I think, was a big surprise. And I do, in some ways, attribute the podcast to some of that. And I'm really glad that I don't carry quite so much vitriol towards the end of season 4 anymore.
Well, it seemed like a lot of people did. I wasn't as, like, heavy in my social media presence or using it too much around then, and I try not to during big TV show or movie cultural moment so that I can try to reserve some of my own feeling or judgment, but it did seem like a lot of people really didn't like season four. And I just thought, man, wow, like, well, I thought it was better than season three. Mm-hmm. So this felt like a margin of progress for me.
That's so interesting because I very much experienced the opposite of that. I remember seeing so much feedback from fans going, this is the best season since season one. This is as good as season one. I still don't agree with that statement.
Not that I do either.
But it has some of the highest highs of Stranger Things and it has some of the lowest lows. And I think I said that about season three before season four came out. I mean, season three has a couple of my favorite scenes in the entire series. So, and that remains true. My favorite scene of Stranger Things is still the same, that one in season three. So like nothing in season four topped that,
yeah.
Which I know some people are like, really? Running up that hill doesn't top Stephen Robbins, the bathroom scene? Nope.
So they're both very personal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like you have a very personal connection to the Stephen Robbins scene. I have a very personal connection to running up that hill scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can put them side by side. And I don't know, even with my love for running up the hill, I don't think you could necessarily say that like one is better than the other. I think you kind of like the utility of that breaks down. I think they're like equally powerful.
Well, except we referred to one of those scenes as perfect.
I did.
Well, I agree with you, though. I agree with you. I said, yeah, you're right.
But we were talking about favorite.
Yes. Scenes,
yes,
which
exactly.
is a subjective yes. matter. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. I feel like there's a D&D theme to how I saw season four and what didn't work for me.
Okay.
And that is like a classic D&D, you don't split the party. This, to me, felt the most split party than any other part of the show. And I feel like, you know, we've had our groups go out in their own ways to investigate this, discover that, connect dots, and then all come together in the end. But this one for me felt so complicated because of just where people were. And then were those moments totally earned later when they did come together?
Mm.
Like I certainly had and wanted to see more out of Jonathan and Nancy when they were reunited, because I guess I just wasn't sure what they were doing anyway throughout all of this season because they weren't together until this moment. And then it kind of just landed flat for me.
Well, hold on. Are you referring to like their actual reunion at in the Wheelers' driveway? Or are you referring to the scene where they're boarding up the windows?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
And I just wanted some more from Jonathan than being a dumb pothead. And then,
same.
And then also maybe it's just a wider critique too, but like in watching this season, my biggest like, oh man, was I didn't realize just how much screen time, joke time, or pulling attention of the show time both Argyle and Jason get throughout the entirety of this season. When I have all these other characters that I care about so much more and you've kept them in the show for what I'm going to believe is reason, then I would want more of that. And we got to see so much out of a character like Jason. And I'm like, but really though? And then watch how that chump went out in the end. Just roted right up through his gut.
I really, really like Jason as a villain. I do agree he wasn't maybe used to his fullest potential, but I think that Jason's actually like the heart of the conflict in Stranger Things as a whole. He is the satanic panic guy. He is the anti-weirdos guy. And Stranger Things at its heart is a bunch of weirdos trying to make their way in the world. And so what are they going to conflict with? Well, people that think that normal is the best way to be or that they should be normal. And Jason should be the villain that kind of pushes that conflict for them. And he is to some degree. But yeah, it's really the way that he goes out, like you said, like I started laughing. Like
when I did too. I rewound it immediately and was like, no way. And then
really?
I giggled again.
Yeah. Like, is that, wow, that's really what they did to him. Okay, then. Yeah, that was disappointing. But I like that he was there and that he was the villain that he was. And I've made this critique of Stranger Things before. They don't go for the message, like, really strongly.
There's a lack of follow through.
Yeah, yeah.
I definitely agree about Jason being, like, the heart of that conflict. But I do feel like his going out the way that he did, I was like, oh, man, after all of that, I was like, how interesting would it have been if he had just lived, though? I was like, because he saw all of this.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, that could have just
Or died by his own hubris or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful. That's what my husband said. He was like, you know, I wanted him to like die, or maybe not die, but be brought down by his own doing, basically. Mm-hmm. That would have been so satisfying. But this season is not exactly the most satisfying. Like you were saying, the parties don't come together. Some of the more satisfying moments in the earlier seasons are when they do come together and they mm-hmm. pool their information. They figure things out together. It's so, you know, it's great. Even if not every single person is there, still a bunch of them are. And in this season, we really don't get that quite as much.
I think the thing you're both are hitting on is this idea that, like, the introduction of those characters are both really strong. I think that the inclusion of those characters is really strong. I think that they both, even are, you know, including Argyle, because I do think that to some degree, you do need some of that levity. The problem is that they sort of back themselves into this corner where they introduce characters really well. It's like both one of their strongest qualities about this show is that they really introduce very compelling characters
and then kill them.
Well, they either kill them or they don't follow through with them.
Yeah.
Like
Lost Sister right there.
It's a kind of a catch 22. It's kind of an impasse with introducing characters like that because, you know, I mean, Heidi, you said it before. I think I'd even credited you again last episode, or very recently anyway, about how Jason is such a fully realized villain in terms of what he represents in the real world
mm-hmm.
and how valuable that is. But I also don't disagree with you that it, like, as much as I appreciate Jason and Argyle as characters and I value their inclusion in this season, it does take attention away from some of the other characters. Now, I personally think there are other aspects of season four that they could have nipped and tucked. Like, mm-hmm. Like I said, it's like a catch 22 of they introduce really good characters, and that's why they keep, you know, that's why I think the argument is there in the fandom of like, but they need to kill more people off because it's too big. It's too big of a roster. And not because of Eddie, you know, mm-hmm. the idea of like, you got to stop introducing characters either to kill them off or to have them take up screen time.
My honestly most objective, biggest critique of season four is that I do not understand, agree with, however you want to phrase it. Like, I don't feel that Elle's powers should have stayed gone. Like, this whole arc that she had to go on to get her powers back, I think is reductive based on the journeys that she as a character has already gone through. And I think that, like, the only reason that she ended up going on this arc is because they were like, well, she's one of our main characters. She has to have an arc. But I really agree with the split party. And Robin, I think it's a great point that we have, like, talked around, but that I haven't heard you, like, explicitly say, but that is really good, is that they have such a strength when mm-hmm. it comes to introducing characters every season. But I think, like, the reason that we haven't talked as much about that is because I know I, at least, am always bitching about how they only introduce characters to then kill them off. So yeah, I get that it's like a catch-22, but in the case of Argyle and Jason specifically, I can't help but love them just because, you know, they're so sparkly, both in their own ways.
Yeah.
You know, like Argyle is such a delight. Jason would make great target practice. What can I say?
And there's yeah. a beautiful irony in that too. Like there's, yeah. I remember like one of the very first, like which Stranger Things character are you quizzes I ever took. And I got Jonathan. And I remember it saying in season three that Jonathan has begun to feel expendable and I don't like that.
Sometimes I wonder if like that's a symptom of the too much character.
Yeah.
I have to get this much into the show or dang, that was so well done in our last bit. I guess we just got to wrap it up with maybe a single line or two.
Speaking of characters and new characters, something that happened recently was that Heidi and I actually went to go see The Breakfast Club because it was screening at a local cinema. I believe you had some thoughts about potentially a certain character's influence.
Yeah. As we were watching it, I was looking at Bender both in terms of like, how, like, just how he acts, but also, even more specifically than that, how he's dressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh shit, it's Eddie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And like, I have seen, you know, I had seen The Breakfast Club before, so this wasn't like a completely like new cultural experience for me, but I hadn't actually connected the dots. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure that there have been other people who have talked about it on social media, but I just hadn't seen it. And, but just seeing like, okay, we've got the t-shirt, then we've got the flannel, then we've got the denim, we've got the long hair, and then the like, you know, different like accoutrements that he like has, like his shoes are messed up and he's got like the wallet with the chain. And so he's just like always got like, I don't know, just like,
he's so dirty and so ragged, yet at the same time, so put together.
And yeah, like, so like such a pristine sense of style, despite having this air of being dirty, like even his hair is like actually really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And like, all of that carries over like really precisely to Eddie. And you have this like this character who in Bender who like has this energy of just absolutely like fuck off, mm-hmm. you know, like is just jagged in mm-hmm. in how he like presents, but has this really like vulnerable core. In the Breakfast Club, they make you wait some time before you start seeing that with Bender. But with Eddie, it's almost like a switch is flipped, like really, really quickly. Like the second he starts talking to Chrissy, mm-hmm. you see this like entirely new side of himself. And I thought that was really interesting. And then you and I chatted a little bit about how that comparison kind of reframes how obnoxious Eddie is in his like introduction scene and kind of like softens how irritating we both find him in that scene.
Yeah.
He's so aggressive.
Well, well, right down to the fact, like the thing that jumped out to me was the fact that like I hadn't seen Breakfast Club in a long time and I completely forgot about how Bender imitates like life at Brian's house and how he like he goes out of his way to make these like long judgments on like, I know exactly what your life is like. And that reminds me very much of how he talks to Dustin and Mike. And I mean, even before he starts throwing them around, he's like, you were dressed like this and you were dressed like that. And then I like transformed you. But yeah, weirdly, seeing that as an influence makes, like I've used this expression elsewhere this season, but like it took some of the air out of it.
Speaking about things too, like Breakfast Club being an influence, I feel like there's so many 80s, I don't know, spheres of culture that are influencing Stranger Things. Like we had talked about Footloose, obviously so many different horror elements that influence this too. And I love that this season brought in Robert Englund. And in talking about, you know, the tone again, the geographical locations being different, this is where Russia also once again really does not fit for me, because there was so much, even in California, I felt the 80s pot Cheech and Chong movie, but also there was actually still some sense of agency in those movies with what those characters were doing, even if they were just on like a high trip. And so I felt that influence, but the Russia one is where I'm just like, wow, I really don't see where this one fits in the formula or doesn't work for me. I don't feel the 80s horror influence and I just didn't feel it all coming together. So Russia really does come to me every time. And I'm just going to riff on that too. It just feels like I hit this halt of like, oh, I'm in a different movie now.
Mm-hmm. Tonal whiplash is strong mm-hmm. in this season.
Yeah.
Like Robin said earlier.
Well, but also the Russia arc is constantly having to try to justify its existence because it doesn't, it's not connected. I think all four of us have said at one point this season how the Russia arc, point blank, it has no connection to Hawkins at all. And I really feel like one of the things that I was surprised by the most in season four was that Hopper was not in the Upside Down. I was so sure that when they did that stinger at the end of season three, that Hopper was going to be in the Upside Down and the American, in quotes, was Brenner. Because if that had been the case, it would have tied Russia to Hawkins so much more strongly. Yeah. And a lot of people disagreed with me. I mean, I think it was like, no way, it's got to be Hopper. That makes way more sense. And I'm like, it's the more obvious thing to do. Yeah. And I think my thought was, yeah, you're probably right, but I hope that it's Brenner. And then I hope that Hopper's in the Upside Down. And I just feel like that would have
been so cool.
Yeah.
Yes, can confirm. I'm already like, that would have been so cool.
And it would have condensed so much of it. I think Jenna and Steve, I think you two are on one side of this. And I think Heidi and I are on the other, which is, I think we're all in agreement that like Russia feels very separate.
Yeah.
But I think you two feel more like it's just not as compelling. But I think Heidi and I think enjoy it a little more than the two of you did. That's just probably an impression.
Yeah, probably.
It's compelling, but it's just, I don't know what mm-hmm. it is. It's not what I expected out of the show, maybe.
I'll go ahead and say that that's probably another big surprise, was that, like, in the rewatch, I found that I actively enjoyed those sequences more than I think I did the first time through, because I was like, yeah, this is completely irrelevant, but it's the way it's constructed is more compelling to me than the California arc.
Sure.
Yeah. But
I think I enjoyed it probably more on this second watch because I knew how much deep characterization we were going to be getting into with Hopper. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, those, like, conversations between him and Antonov Enzo, and him talking about his experience in Vietnam and him talking about his daughter, like, that is some incredible payoff that we, like, we know that these things happened to him, but we haven't heard him talk about it quite in that way. And, like, that underlying thing of, like, this is my fault, even though we know, of course, it's not. Yeah, looking forward to that and knowing where the journey was headed and knowing, like, where Hopper was going to end up character-wise, I think made it a little bit more worth it to me. Despite, you know, again, when I step back and I'm like, if I'm looking at, like, the season as if it's like a map, you know, it doesn't. This is a puzzle piece that doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fair.
A lot of the bloat in this season, I think, is in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree with that, too. There's just not as many characters involved in the Russia story that I can care about. And then I just don't feel like enough of the narrative happening in Russia is working towards any of the other shared aspects that the other parties are dealing with. And I do love that monologue in the jail cell with Enzo, because that is such a big moment. I wish that had just happened with somebody else. I can get behind the trust of a stranger and telling them something random and being like, you know, that felt cathartic because you're just that person to me right now in this moment in my life. But there was a part of me that was like, man, I really wish that had happened with, like, Joyce.
Yeah.
I think it's possible we're going to get some of that sort of stuff in season 5.
Hope so.
I think they're saving it.
Yeah. I think mostly that monologue was meant to be between us and Hopper, though. Like, it didn't even really matter who else was in, well, who he was actually mm-hmm. talking to. And I was actually surprised because I remember in some of the, maybe not marketing, but the coming up on season 4, David Harbour was talking about how, yeah, in this season, we're going to get into more of Hopper's war experience. And I was surprised at how much Russia stuff there was that didn't have anything to do with his backstory. Yeah. That's why I feel like the bloat was all there. Like, we finally got that one monologue, which was really good, but I had been expecting more the entire time. So that was just kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. The difference between California and Russia, I think, apart from the one sequence at Susie's house, I think the difference between the two in terms of how the runtimes are padded is in Russia, it is exactly that. It's just padded runtime. It's things that could have been drastically condensed. And then the other side of that is that California, it's just a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. It's, okay, we have to get them here. We need this to happen. And then the kind of connecting piece of that is Joyce and Murray. Like, until they get to Hopper, they kind of have both. It's to-ing and fro-ing, and it's a bunch of stuff that could have been condensed.
How freaking long are these episodes?
Yeah. Like, come on, guys. Yeah. The geographic distance. And I understand they wanted the four groups for season 4. But yeah. So I guess that kind of brings me to a question. I've kind of already sort of given my answer, which is, like, if you could change one singular thing about season 4, one thing outside of character deaths,
mm-hmm.
you know, for me, it would be exactly what I just said. Hopper would have been in the Upside Down. Brenner would have been in Russia. For you guys, what would it be?
Elle's storyline. If I could just really distill down to one small thing, I would say the cutting of her hair, because that's so deeply mm-hmm. symbolic mm-hmm. of regression. But the entire thing where she just basically regresses in order to get her powers back or whatever, I hate that. I hate mm-hmm. all of that.
Yeah.
So that entire thing with her in Nina.
We're pretty unanimous in that. Yeah, we're all nodding. Yeah.
That would be the one thing.
I was going to say, I feel like my brother gave me this critique and I giggled because I didn't feel like he was wrong, But he was like, dude, her powers are so inconsistent. She's about as consistent as a Dragon Ball Z episode right now. He was like, you never know who is the more powerful character because they try to tease you that way. But you always knew that this character was more powerful all along.
I feel like anime powers, though, are like a law unto themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And their inconsistencies are so real. And I felt like that was inconsistent here. The way that Eleven was baited into being there, and that felt very just like abuse. I just didn't like that either.
Yeah.
And to then have that happen and then be like, oh, I need to regress to gain more power. And then by the time I'm in what I'm going to call Elception, which is the finale.
like that. That's
that,
great.
At that point, I was like, well, dang, like, she should be so powerful right now.
Yeah.
And I didn't really see that happen or that comeuppance, and not in the same way that I saw her at the end of season two, you know, standing on that rig with Hopper right next to her while she was just letting it out. And that is one of my favorite moments of the whole show. So I was, I'm just with that. That was probably, I would want to change something there because Elle's story affects everybody's story. And I think that hers is so important that she's the key to the biggest spider web that is Stranger Things. So I would drastically change things in this season for Elle.
I also think that I would go with Elle's arc just because it's so inconsistent with the rest of the show. It's so inconsistent with her character. And Steve, I think you make a, you and your brother make a great point about the anime thing, because one thing that we talked about, Robin and I talked about, is in Henry's fight with Eleven, it's a lot of no, you're finished, and that's a huge thing in anime. It's like, I'm gonna hit you with a fireball, and now I'm gonna hit you with this, and now I'm gonna hit you, and it's great in anime, but it doesn't.
I believe at one point I said something, I think it might have been in our reactions episodes, I was saying, you're the monster, no, you're the monster, and you went, you, me, and Cookie Monster.
Yeah, it got silly, and in a way that, you know, either it typically doesn't in anime, or like you're used to that being a part of the art form, so you're, you know, you're braced for it.
I saw a tweet or something maybe a couple years ago by, honestly can't remember who, but they were like, people always ask in superhero settings, who would win in a fight between X and Y? Mm-hmm. And the answer is whoever the writers need to win for the story. Mm-hmm. Anime doesn't do that because there's tournament arcs where it's literally just like, well, this person has this powers and this person has this powers. Let's do a whole thing where we make them fight just for the hell of it. And like, that's one of my least favorite things about anime, that and all the, let's just say all our thoughts out loud kind of things. But if we're specifically talking about, I can't stand it. Okay. but if we're talking about a show like Stranger Things, that's going to be one where it doesn't really matter whose powers are what. It matters who the writers want to win, so to speak, in order to make the story what they want to make it.
Yeah, that juxtaposition of like her taking down that helicopter and then the non-fight with VH1. I'm like, what are you trying to communicate to us about their powers? This makes no sense.
It felt as inconsistent as anime for sure. And oh my gosh, the no, you or I'm more powerful. I'm going to hit you with this.
You're
now
the monster.
It this really isn't does. Even my final form.
Exactly.
Papa made you like this. Noel, you did. Okay. All right.
Yeah. I just wish there was more that I could follow in that. Because like, I guess if I'm also going to dig into where I love fights as both a fight choreographer and someone who consumes that entertainment too, like the beats need to make sense and still need to tell a story. And I didn't really feel like there was one in that fight. All of this on the backdrop of me being like, cool, so we're in Max's head dream.
Yes.
And Elle is here, but Vecna is inducing this. Okay, cool. So that's why it's Elception to
but
me now.
But while, and like Heidi pointed out, like, but Max is passed out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so
how
weird.
Do you lose consciousness within your own consciousness while other people continue to invade your consciousness, which has lost consciousness?
Yeah. Ask, you know what? Ask Christopher Nolan. I bet he has an answer.
These are good questions.
Yeah.
But I also drew another anime parallel when I was talking to you about that final fight, or when Elle was facing off with Vecna, yeah, being restrained. I'm like, that reminded me so much of anime trope of, you know, taking the powerful young girl and rendering her helpless. Like, that's such a gross trope. Mm-hmm. And it's not just an anime thing, I think. It's a really gross male power fantasy kind of thing. That's where a lot of abuse comes from in general. But well,
yeah.
What was the thing that you quoted? We talked about it where you said, like, hey, your fetish is showing.
Yeah.
Where did you find that? I remember you brought it up and I can't remember from where you found it from.
Somewhere on the internet, people talking about TV shows like Community, where it's like, you know, oh, this is the writer's fetish, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's a gross yeah. trope that could be one of those things, yeah.
I mean, there was a whole lot of tentacles this season.
Mm-hmm.
And like with Elle being in the, like, you know, Robin, you referred to it as the Christ pose.
Yep.
And then Vecna, like,
yeah.
leaning yeah, wow, over her and doing the whole, like,
gross.
It doesn't have to be this way. I wanted you by my side. And I was like, bro, what the fuck?
Gross. And, gross.
So. You know, if that's the kind of fan fiction you're into, I am not here to judge you. However,
yeah.
The symbolism was very, very clear.
Yeah. And I don't want people to say things like, oh, but then we have Nancy and we have, you know, we don't do the same thing with these other female characters. And I would say, well, it doesn't fucking matter because we have it right. here with Elle. Mm-hmm. We have it here. It's enough right here and to be bad.
And to a very real extent, we have it with Max as well.
Yes.
It's different, but it comes from the same.
One of the things is, this is making me think of a quote I read by, it was in Trevor Noah's book. His mom said to him, well, I married a man like your dad because, or he wanted to marry me because certain type of abusers don't want weak women. They want a powerful woman that they mm-hmm. can subdue. That's a fantasy, a power fantasy that a lot of men have. And that's kind of what I feel like happens here. Max is a very strong personality and Elle is very powerful. So they get to beat down these particular, you know, strong-willed girls, not even women. And it's just gross.
Very, very predatorial. I don't love it.
Let us not forget that Nancy does end up pinned to a wall.
Yeah, that too.
So mm-hmm. does Robin. And yes, Steve does also. But like, again, look at how that's like the majority of your female characters right there.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Look at how it's shot, too. Like,
yeah. And Erica gets tackled, too.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that, like, oh, our characters shouldn't be, you know, beat down in any way ever, you know, but, like, come on, guys.
It's a little much. All of these characters, by the way, are men that are perpetuating it, and that shit's real. And I feel like we're not seeing the other side of that being a bad thing. So much as it's just inciting crisis and need for the narrative. And I don't like that at all.
What are some of our like biggest lingering questions from season four?
In this convergence of wherever VH1 has been this entire time into Hawkins, I'm certainly wondering if we'll get answers out of like, what was he doing there all this time? Or will we get some deconstructive storytelling on that? Or will we begin to understand other properties of that realm? Is it the same thing as the Upside Down? Does it even follow any of the same rules? I don't know. Or is it somewhere in between? I don't know. But I feel like this is the point in the D&D game where stuff is going to start going over my head because we're talking about planes of existence all converging on one another. And so I'm wondering how those rules will apply in Hawkins. Like, that place and that space clearly made VH1 very powerful. I'm wondering if that will also be the anchor to his weakness. Like, now that the planes are converging, is he weaker here now because he's not in his whole realm? I don't know. Anyway, so those are already some things I'm immediately wondering, in addition to just, you know, like, who's gonna die?
That's always the question. Who's gonna mm-hmm. die and who's gonna be together romantically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what fandom wants to know.
Love, mm-hmm. love and death. Yeah. Give us more.
Yeah.
I want my characters to suffer, but also experience love and happiness.
Yeah. I want to die in love.
Can we please? I'm ready for them to kind of narrow it down a little bit. And, or, you know, if they decide to never give us specifics on what exactly the Upside Down is, I think I'd be okay with that as well. Fandom is, of course, very good at taking a little information and making a lot of, you know, rumors out of it. And that's fine. That's fun. That's fun mm-hmm. to do. So, you know, we'll see what they do.
Yeah. I think one of my biggest questions, I've said it at least once, but what is the shadow? not the mind flayer. What is the shadow? This essence, yeah. is it sentient? And that kind of brings me back to, you know, this thing that Heidi and I have been discussing since season one, which technically we got an answer, is the Upside Down sentient. It functions as a character even now, but I think there's this like almost reflex to think based on the information we got in season four that the Upside Down has just always been Henry Creel. But I still feel like there's a piece of that that's not totally been made clear. Is it just literally an atmospheric energy that he was able to channel, like a dust cloud, or is it some kind of sentient force? So whether that ends up playing a role in you know, kind of like what you said, Steve, about like, is that going to be like how they defeat him, or is it just a, you know, kind of background information that we still don't have that might just make the whole thing kind of pull just that much more into focus?
Curious, what other horror movie influences in particular could be out there? Because every season has had pretty strong, like, horror contributions to it.
Yeah.
So something we talked about last year, I think, was the Duffer Brothers are going to work on some other horror adaptation. I think it was a Stephen King thing, wasn't it? Do you remember what that was?
Don't remember what it was. I know that they've talked about their next, the first like Upside Down Pictures production they're going to do is another series, but it's an original.
Yeah, there was some other
adaptation. I'm curious.
It was The Talisman.
Oh, that's right.
Which was written by Stephen King and another guy.
And that's what
Lucas' name doesn't matter.
And other guy.
Sorry, other author.
Well, and that's what Lucas is reading to Max.
They actually apparently were maybe going to adapt that.
Oh,
did
wow.
It, I wonder if it went through.
The only news...
Well, nothing's going through right now.
The last time I could find on a 2-minute Google search that they talked about it was last, I think it was May, they talked about it a little bit. Haven't seen anything since then, so who knows?
Yeah. I guess we'll have to see. We'll have to see where that goes.
Time will tell.
It would be interesting to see what that would look like because they've done a lot of pastiche of Stephen King. It would be interesting to see, like, okay, what does their take on an actual Stephen King
That'd
property
cool.
look like? Yeah.
I'm here for it.
Yeah. And which members of this enormous cast are they going to borrow?
Also probably true. Because I could stand for the Duffer Brothers to turn into, like, a Mike Flanagan of sorts, where they have their own troop of people that continue to make more stories, more adventures, and then, yeah, cherry pick a handful of folks along the way. I would really love that.
But I'm much more excited about the next series they're going to work on is called The Burrows. And according to this article from Tudum, the series takes place in a picturesque retirement community in New Mexico desert, where a group of, you guessed it, unlikely heroes must band together to defeat an otherworldly threat from stealing the one thing that they don't have, time. According to the creators and showrunners, Jeffrey Addis and Will Matthews, who are alums of the Dark Crystal Age of Resistance, making The Burrows alongside the Duffer Brothers has been a, quote, dream come true.
Mm.
So I'm interested in that premise just from that. Like, genuinely, I'm a lot more interested in that than, like, any other adaptation that they might do, because this feels like a lot of the same elements that they had with Stranger Things, but if it's a retirement community, that makes me think that we might have some older protagonists, mm-hmm. which, like, I think that would be kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, like, some people working at the facility who might be younger. Like, so you might have another one of these, like, mix of age groups, but, like, they don't have really, like, older characters on Stranger Things. So that would be kind of a new, and like the environment will be totally different. So I'm very interested. I'm way more interested in this than I am the play.
Yeah. I'm not interested in the play at all. When I heard they were doing that, I was kind of like, you know, in some respects, I like some mixed media here and there with a brand. Like, for instance, I liked the Avengers musical that was included in Hawkeye because it was like meta and self-referential of mm-hmm. actual events that happened, and like that was kind of cute. It was kitschy. And then I heard that Marvel Disney is actually doing the
Rogers.
Actual Avengers or Rogers the musical.
The musical.
They're doing like a small run of it in a handful of Disney places. I actually think that's kind of exciting, given the context of it having been a thing in the show. It's already in their world. That could make a viewer feel like, oh, I'm in the Marvel Universe because I'm seeing Rogers mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. musical. That's cool, but I'm just not seeing where the tie-in is here for a Stranger Things play at all. It feels like something nobody asked for, and I'm waiting for that to be the meme, the like me nothing. Nobody asked for this. Insert Stranger Things play.
What I thought at first was, oh, this is going to be a character study. This is going to be like, because the premise initially was, we know that it's set in, it's in the 70s. It's Hopper, Joyce, Bob. They all are in Hawkins High. It's right before they graduate. It's right before Hopper gets, you know, goes to Vietnam. That felt like, okay, if this is like a slice of life, it's just like, what were their lives like right before? Cool. That actually I could be interested in. I won't be able to see it in London's West End anytime soon, but that at least I can appreciate what it's for. And then when they added the deal in the synopsis of, but then new student Henry Creel comes to town, I'm like, why go there? Yeah, like, prequels are so difficult to do, you know, making it, then it's going to be inaccessible. Like, if it was a novel, I might be more interested. But because it would be accessible, and I'm wondering if they're going to do like what they did with like The Cursed Child, which is they will release the play. Yeah. And I wonder if that's going to be their way of making it accessible to everybody. But it's a weird move. Like, yeah, it's an odd direction, like, especially when they've had so much success with the graphic novels and the, you know, the companion novels that they've released. It just seemed like a surprising direction.
Yeah, like, I love multimedia format, and I love being a fan of a franchise or a thing and being able to relish more than just, I guess, the original property. So in this case, the Netflix show. But then I start to wonder things like, I'm going to pull something out of thin air here, but I don't know if anybody here has ever played Kingdom Hearts, but I loved that game. There are three major installments of that game, and then there's a whole bunch of offshoots that I'm just kind of like, wait, mm-hmm, what? Why do you even have these? Why do they have all these silly titles when there's just Kingdom Hearts 1, 2, and 3? So in the Stranger Things sense, for me, this is one where I'm like, I'm probably going to be a purist here, but the show is just going to be the only thing that's really going to exist for me.
If you, the listener, are like super excited about the play, have my extra viewings. Like, absolutely enjoy it. Don't, you know, don't let me yuck your yum, but I'm not really all that interested in it.
Just in that same D&D vein real quick, just want to also shamelessly say that there is a great 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons pack out there that is out of print now, I think, but it's Stranger Things oriented, and it entreats you to be a kid in the town of Hawkins, and that these events are going on, but that you are just adjacent to all of it. And it's sort of like, what do you and your pals do? So it's your party. And it's sort of like I'm riding my bike through Hawkins and I'm doing this and I'm going to go meet up with Jenna and Heidi and we're going to talk about what we investigated last night at the school. That was the first time I'd ever played a game that kind of gave us rules that were like, you can't just be the character that you totally want. Like, you are a kid.
Mm-hmm, right.
And you have to play as a kid in that campaign module. And that started a whole new something in me and those players, because we were just like, wow. We've never all just decided as a group something like, let's all play as kids.
Yeah.
And that was fun both for our inner childs and spirit, as well as it was fun for the game. Yeah. Please play.
So much good discussion happening here. But this is turning into a mammoth-sized episode. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to pause our discussion right here, and we're going to split this discussion into two episodes, maybe three. And so... yeah, this is going to conclude our conversation for the moment on our general season 4 wrap-up thoughts and our lingering questions. In our next episode, we'll be talking about hopes, fears, expectations. There will probably be a few clips from my conversation that I had also with Ashley and Jasmine back in Chapter 3 regarding some of their hopes, fears, and expectations. And then there may very well be a little bonus episode that will be D&D themed. But until then, thank you for listening, as always, and until our next episode, over and out. Did you have any, like, big lingering questions?
Yeah, what the fuck?
Nailed it. Nailed it.
Yeah. What the fuck, Vecna, upside down, yeah. You know, just in general.
Yeah. Like, we all four of us talked about this, and I didn't even think of that. Season 4 wrap up. We have 4 people. I just thought of that.
Yeah.
Anyway.